Just a few brief parameters. Tonight is just a background session. We'll start tomorrow afternoon with bills. It's my hope that people addressing the committee will be succinct. We've all sat through far too many committee meetings over the last 2 months, 5 months, far too long committee meetings, and I hope we can keep these as to the point as possible and not roam too far from the issues we have before us. In terms of the way I like to operate a committee is starting as close to hunt time as possible, and I do it preferred on a first name basis, and the only real requirement I like is that work through me in terms of just identifying ourselves, so it's easier on Patty to keep us the record straight for us. That being said, Kenneth?
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ken Lowell, Deputy Director of PERS. With me this evening to make a presentation on your retirement system are Jerry Liebertz, our Assistant Director of PERS, and our actuary from the firm of Milliman and Robertson, Mark Johnson. If I may refer to the outline in the notebook, what we would intend to do is present an overview consisting of reference to the law, the board's goals and objectives. That's where I would intend to spend most of my time. The membership, the staff, our information program for the members, the funding, the contributions that come into the system, and then a brief synopsis of the bills that have been introduced so far this session. Jerry will delve into the benefits as they are currently provided, and we'll wrap up with the comments by the actuary with respect to funding. So that's just a quick run through the agenda. Please stop us at any time with questions. The law of the system, the benefits that are provided are only those in Section 237, ORS Chapter 237. There are no discretionary benefits that are extended by staff or by the retirement board. If you haven't adopted a benefit here, our staff does not pay it. All benefits come through the legislature and only through that source, amended from time to time by the court system. Our goals and objectives are found behind tab 2 in your book. Back in 1979, the board spent approximately 2 years prior in the development of those goals. The philosophy of the system is that the coverage of all Oregon public employees is preferable in PERS. The board does not find it helpful were benefits for public employees to be splintered and provided through separate systems, although there are some, and in fact there is a bill introduced into this session that would allow one group of employees to go off on their own. In terms of who pays for the benefits, the board has stated that that should remain outside the salary setting mechanism. Who pays for the benefits can be a negotiable item. Retirement benefits for all participants in PERS should be based on the same single benefit rate. In other words, we should not discriminate between classes of employees. All employees should receive the same single benefit. And a reasonable balance should be maintained between benefits for members and fiscal responsibility for the employers and the taxpayers that have to fund those benefits. Now, with respect to funding, the board felt that the system should continue to be a contributory system. In other words, the members should continue to provide part of their own benefit, which they do. Employer contributions should be based on funding the system's existing unfunded supplemental present value over a 30-year period, and that they are doing. PERS, Oregon PERS, is possibly unique in that we're probably one of the better funded state systems in the country. The fact that we have an unfunded supplemental present value is not necessarily a criticism. What would be a criticism if we didn't know what that value was. Our value is identified, we're amortizing that cost and paying it off. New benefits that are created.
Chairman.
Yes, Danny.
You mentioned just a short time ago that the rate all should be the same.
Yes.
The rate of the retirement that that employee would get, or the rates going in. Well, the rates may all be the same, but the amount of money going in is certainly different than the employer's contribution is different based on. So I guess what you're saying then, the rate would be different, but the amount of money would certainly not be the same. Or, I mean, would be the same, but not the amount of money that you would receive would not be the same.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones. The what the board is saying is that all benefits should be determined based on the same scale and depending on a person's salary and length of service.
Right, but you withhold more. The more you make, the more you withhold.
That's correct. Would you like to touch on that, Jerry? The amount received by the person is different, but the formula used to arrive at that benefit is
the ingoing formula is not the same, though, because
no,
the more you make, the rate changes there.
That's
the
correct.
Percentage rate changes.
That's correct.
Of the contribution. So you get more money in, but then do you get, if you put in more, do you get more out?
Yes, exactly. The person who contributes more, and in our system, we have a system based on, it's a career system based on years of service, and so the person who works longer receives more. In other words, the person who spends a 30-year career with their employer will receive far more than the member who works for 5 years, for
example. Right, but then let's take in consideration then the people that are buying back in, or at least attempting to, and those that have over the years with special legislation to fit certain individuals and so on have bought back in, but they don't have the years of experience to apply to that. So, but their rate would be the same, but they wouldn't get quite as much money. In dollars, would they?
That's correct. In other words, the years of service is very important, and the person who has less years of service receives a lower benefit. You want to touch on that, Jerry?
Representative Jones, I think there's a couple of factors. One, because of an IRS ruling, and to be a qualified plan, we can only have one contribution rate, 6%. Now, if somebody's salary is $10,000 a year, they're going to pay in 6% of that, and if somebody's is $30,000, they're going to pay in 6% of that. When they retire, their benefit is going to be based on three items. One, the length of service, and if that was the same, times the factor, if that was the same, but one is going to have a $30,000 salary and one is going to have a $10,000 salary.
Yes, but if you're below that, your rate is not 6%.
No.
It hasn't been in the past.
Representative Bauman, in the past it is not, but since 1979, everybody's rate is 6%. Because of the IRS ruling.
That's fine.
Okay. The board has indicated in terms of funding that the board should review in detail and approve all significant actuarial assumptions. And this they have just done. We have a valuation underway right now, and we hope to, by the end of this month, have the results of that study. These are an interesting set of goals and objectives, and that the next one, further study should be given to the concept of a uniform employer contribution rate for the entire system. I got ahead of myself, excuse me. That we have not taken up, but the board was indicating that we should study that further. They indicate a single reserve should be used for all contingencies. There would be no required level of the reserve in the law, but the board could establish a rule for determining an appropriate level. Presently, We do have a reserve, and the board has indicated they would like to have, at least in concept, 2 years of distribution set aside. And after our, we had very good earnings last year, and they do have a sum of money set aside in that reserve at the end of 1982. The last point under funding is the interest rate credit on an employee contribution should be related to current interest rates and not to anticipated future rates. Currently, in the law, we're required to pay the actuarial assumed rate, whether we earn that or not. And that could cause trouble were it to go on for an extended period of time. Currently, we've had, I think that's been in the law for what, over 5 years, Jerry?
Yes.
Yeah, and we've had no difficulty with it. On the second page, on the back side of that, they touch on the investments. They indicate the investment council is properly structured to establish and monitor the system's investments. The board should continue to be represented on the council by two individuals, and that they are. Roger Meyer, the chairman of the investment council, is an appointee from the retirement board, and Jim McGoffin, the director of the system, serves on the Oregon Investment Council. And the second and last point under investments, the board, through the Oregon Investment Council, desires the flexibility to pursue an investment policy which will maximize investment yields consistent with sound investment principles under the prudent man rule. And now there's several bills introduced this session that would intend to modify that standard. Our board is on record as being opposed to all those amendments. Now, in terms of the benefits, several of these have already been achieved, and it probably tells us we need to sit back down and review our goals and objectives, because they have worked hard, and we have achieved several of these. The system's retirement benefit for a career employee, and career is thought of in terms of 30 years, retiring at age 62, when added to Social Security benefits, should provide the same standard of living immediately after retirement as enjoyed immediately before retirement. So essentially what we're saying is that for the career worker, that after taxes, the member, after they've retired, should be able to have the same level of income as they did when they were in active work life. In other words, they would be drawing the pension from PERS as well as their Social Security benefit. And those two added together should replace their pre-retirement income. And in our system, I think that's achieved by most of the career employees, so we meet that goal. Now, the system is not responsible for maintaining a minimum standard of living for a public employee with less than career service. In other words, many employees will come to government to finish out a second career, for example, being retired from some other previous employment. The board is saying clearly that for the short-term worker, the person who works 5 years, they don't feel the same responsibility to that person. Our system is there to serve the career worker. The purchasing power of benefits after retirement should be maintained. In other words, each legislature, as you are doing now, should consider ad hoc increases to retirees to supplement the 2% annual cost of living increases. And our legislature has been very generous, and when the money has been available, they have always acted to make available whatever they could. 10 years of service should be required for duty and non-duty disabilities. The benefit level should be the same for duty and non-duty disabilities. That is not the case today, but it was an identified goal of the board. Duty disability benefits should be coordinated with other employer-provided sources of disability benefits, for example, workers' compensation and Social Security. In other words, what they're suggesting is that we shouldn't pay twice, or that the taxpayer shouldn't pay twice. Take-home pay after disability should not be greater than before disability. And what they're suggesting is that one of the benefits would be offset, so we wouldn't pay as many as three times for the same injury. The Sixth item here, PERS should be changed to a full formula benefit system, and this you did at, in the 1981 session. We went to the single formula where the general service workers receive 1.67% for each year of service, and police and fire receive 2% for each year of service. So that's a goal that has been accomplished. And number seven, the system's benefits should not vary by sex. Since 1978, they do not. Prior to 78, there were sex-distinct tables, and there is a bill that would amend that activity in this session. Now, in terms of the administration of the system, we'll move on quickly. The ideal size of the board is five persons, and I would point out for the committee that these goals and objectives were adopted back in March of 79, and there are two bills in this session that would change that. And it's certainly contrary to the board's thoughts on that issue. And they elaborate on that. They say the board members should not be elected by, appointed by, or represent special interest groups. And I think the bills that are introduced this session would do just that. They would introduce the element of interest groups. The last item is the board should continue to be constituted of three members, two non-members, all appointed by the state's chief executive. So that's just a quick run-through of the ideas and thoughts by the board that daily oversees the operation of the trust. Now, going on to the next tab, membership, the first
Mr.
chart.
Chairman.
Yes, please.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question. What, under benefits, seven different items there, you mentioned a change, a couple of bills were introduced. So what other bills were introduced that affect these under benefits, seven?
Well,
items there.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, we have 50 bills that have been introduced this session related to the pension plan. In terms of extending benefits, there's been 13 that would add new benefits or benefits that are not currently in
place. Is that the item six?
Well, no, six has been accomplished. The legislature passed item six, adopted the single formula in 1981. And so we've been under that single formula system since.
Well, you got that listed here.
Well, as I indicated, these are a set of goals and objectives that where this board has been successful in actually achieving some of these, and they have not been reviewed and updated since that time. So I think the board could be commended for actually achieving one of them, but it no longer is necessary because we're there.
Does it take special legislation for item number three?
Yes, it does. And there is a bill that would grant an addition over and above the 2% benefit. I think it's Senate Bill 315 that would address that.
State funds are short, but the fund for PERS is not.
You're saying here on
the cost of... consider ad hoc increases, and I think you mentioned something if money was available. It is available.
Well, no, it's not. In other words, were the legislature to grant additional ad hoc benefits, that would require further funding. Mm-hmm. We have sufficient money coming in to pay the benefits that you have adopted to date, but were you to add an additional benefit, that does require further funding.
I guess that's all.
Okay. In terms of membership now, there's a bar chart as the first exhibit there. This is what people generally think of when they think of the pension plan. We have approximately 150,000 members active and vested or deferred in the plan today, and 40,000 who are retired and receive a monthly benefit. Our monthly pension roll is what, Jerry?
$12 million.
Okay, approximately $12 million is mailed out of our office every month to 40,000 people retired from Oregon service. And this shows the breakdown in terms of the number of, there's about 38, 39,000 state employees in the fund. I guess it's 36, I'm sorry. School district employees are the largest single group, teachers, total a little over 47,000. Political subdivisions, those are all the cities and the counties, as well as various districts. They total 27,000. Our vested people, these are people who worked for an employer and then moved on other places but left their money in the system. There's a little over 15,000 members, and retired members are 37.5 at the end of 1982.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Ken.
Ken, the reason that the political subdivision members have increased is not because employment is increasing in the local government sector so much as it is new systems being added.
That's correct. We have our best salesman sitting right next to me, Jerry Leibritz, and in 1982, I don't know the number, I think Jerry had, were there 10 new entities added during 19? Yeah, so we have had a number of entities. There are about, well, a little under 50 separate private police and fire plans out there. And then there's, I don't know the number, but there are maybe that many general service plans, but a number of them have found it advantageous to join the state system, and they have done that. Now,
Sure, Denny?
You mentioned something regarding the contributor, those that had withdrew and those that hadn't. Now, you cannot withdraw the employer part that's put in. Is that right?
Prior to retirement, you cannot.
And, afterwards you can?
No. The only way you ever can reach the employer portion is through retirement. There's always an exception.
Yeah, through your monthly contribution that you get out of.
That's correct.
But now the part that the employee puts in is a separate fund altogether, isn't it?
That's correct. Jerry has a.
But you administer that?
We do.
But it has no bearing on the PERS fund, though.
Well, yes, it does, because it makes up a part of the benefit. The person receives a retirement allowance, and that's made up of, at least in concept, an annuity, which comes from the value of their money, and the pension, which comes from the value of the employer-provided
right.
money. So it very much affects the ultimate payment to.
Well, how about those that withdrew their money and quit here, and some of them are trying to get back in now?
Okay, they have, depending on how long they've been gone, if they've been gone over 5 years, then they forfeit the right to buy that time back. And those are the people who are coming to you now that have been gone more than 5 years and failed to. See, if you come back within 5 years, you have the privilege of redepositing that money. And if they, for whatever reason, fail to do that, then that time is lost. And those are the people who come to you with the various buyback, as they're referred to, concepts.
Right, but they have withdrawn that money and used it for whatever, and then it hasn't earned anything in that period of time. As far as interest is concerned,
Jerry, we credit interest for 5 years, and after 5 years, even if they don't take their money out, we stop crediting interest, but we still hold it unless they ask.
That then would not have any bearing on the amount of money that they get from the employer contribution.
No, those people forfeit any right to the employer portion.
Person has been out for 3 years and comes back in, puts their money back in, it's just as if those 3 years didn't exist. They aren't credited anything, they aren't deducted anything. It's just
it restores the time that they had previously worked. If they had worked for 3 years,
the balance on day one of their second career is just whatever they put back in.
That's correct. They're retired, okay. Yes. Okay.
Is that an all or nothing proposition?
Yes, you cannot make a partial withdrawal. You either take it all out or nothing. Okay.
Well, then another question along that line, yeah. Then. To buy back in, then that would require a contribution from the employer also.
It does. And
that's where it gets a little bit rocky, going over the ridge.
Well, that's hard to understand because people think, well, look, I worked, and while I was there, the employer contributed for me. Why isn't that money still there? After 5 years, the right to the benefit is terminated. And then the actuary, in future valuations, takes those previous contributions and spreads them over all the other lives under the employer's plan, and those are used to fund other obligations that the employer has.
At a little higher rate, or you get benefit of the ones that have opted out of the system, so those that stayed in get a little better cut out of it then.
What happens, sir, is that when somebody leaves and forfeits the money that their employer put in, that money is used to reduce the contributions for that employer. It doesn't increase anyone else's benefit. It goes to the employer.
Mr. Chairman, it's kind of a re-spreading of the money that's in the system. Once you withdraw your contributions, you forfeit your rights. So the system no longer says these are your monies that the employer put in. They are monies that belong to the system. You forfeited your rights, and the next time they do the valuation, they respread those monies over the remaining obligations that the system has.
That's correct, because the statute says that that money cannot go for that person, since that person has forfeited the right, and the only logical thing to do with that money is to spread it out.
I'm sorry, I missed your answer.
To the employer, not to the employees.
I'm sorry, I missed your answer. So when this individual comes back in, they put up whatever they took out in the back hole, what does the employer have to do at that point?
Well, the next time a valuation is performed, that employer will be short some money. So their rate would jump up just a hair for that. But that would be compensated because 5 years ago, his rate went down a little bit because he had some extra money.
Gotcha. Okay.
Now, just still on the membership area, something that I think not infrequently gets overlooked, we talk about the employees in the system. In the state retirement system are 792 individual employers, of which the state of Oregon is only one employer, and we've listed here for you the participating employers. There are presently 160 cities in the state plan. There are 33 counties, 337 school districts. There are 94 separate state agencies. Other political subdivisions total 154, and 14 community colleges, and that should total to 792. So I point that out just for emphasis that while we were called the state retirement system, there are more non-state employees in the state pension plan than there are state workers. Just in terms of our staff, there's a small organization chart here.
Excuse me, Ken.
Yes.
I assume this is a dumb question, but it seems to me the broader that base, the more stable the fund. Is that, I mean, that makes you look better?
Well, you have different viable employers paying in, and if one's going to get into trouble, that's not, they're still responsible for their own experience. But I don't know. I want to pass that the actuary. Does that help, Mark?
Each employer has a rate that's determined for that employer. The state is considered one employer. All Oregon school districts are considered one employer. And everybody else has their own account. And we determine a unique employer contribution rate for every one of those employers. When a new employer comes in, we do a study to determine what their contribution rate should be from the employer.
So and when Wallala County goes bad, or something goes real bad.
Wallala County pays for it.
It doesn't hurt Wasco County.
That's correct.
Okay, our organization staff here, PERS is staffed by 65 employees, and I believe about 61 of us work in our headquarters in Portland, and then we have four field offices. We have an office in Eugene, an office here in Salem, and an office out in Pendleton, and then we have one, what we refer to as a field worker, who operates out of our Portland office. So that's the staff that's available to serve the members of the system. And that's all I'll touch on staff, unless there's questions. Now, our information...
I'd like to ask a question.
Surely.
All of the various school districts are based on a single formula.
That's correct.
If one of the school districts, you talked about Wasco and Wallace County, that wouldn't affect one another, but if one school district is paying higher rates for one reason or another, he is paying.
We allowed people back in 1977 to buy back some time. Now it's opened the door. We last 1981, there was a bill passed that opened the door for some people to buy back, and it was passed. As a result of that, now we have a bigger group of people who say they would like to buy back, and that group gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and that's where the cost will come to the system. I think the retirement benefit program that we have, I think, and I'm sure the board should be proud of, the fact that what we can retire. We can retire at age 58 regardless of years. We can retire at 55 with 30 years. I think that maybe one of the interesting remarks that I could make, I know our actuaries wish that they had the same program as well as we did. I know that. I happen to know that for a fact. But the retirement benefits, instead of maybe trying to change a lot of these little add-on features, if the money is there and the legislature wants to, I think they can increase that 167 formula, or the 2% formula as it is for the police and fire in those two groups, something along that line. But I think to continually add on little bits and to go to a select group and give them a benefit, all we're really doing is we're coming up to the next one and say, what about the next group? I think a bill should be passed, in my estimation, should cover everybody.
Great. I like that.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir. Do you compare this system? Is there any system in the United States, either private or state, that is comparable to this one? And do you compare them? And if you do, how does ours compare?
Representative Bauman, Representative Simpson. Yes, there's an organization. We keep track of all 50 programs in the United States. When you compare them, I think you must compare two things. One, the benefits, and one, the funding of it.
Okay.
There are some that have far better benefits, but the funding is something that's left to be desired. But if you took both of those into consideration, I think we could be very, very proud of where we would stand if you took both the funding in this program and the benefits. It's not the greatest idea. People think that it is magic, but not too many years ago, where the state of Michigan could not pay that pension roll.
Yeah.
It's a great system. Nevada has had some troubles with their system. California had. So the program may be great, but if there's no money behind it, I would much rather have a little less benefits, but know that the money is there as we have in this program. Representative Bowen, if there's the only other thing that I would like to mention is that by participating in this program, I think one of the biggest problems facing people who are about to retire today is what do we do about our hospitalization coverage. Our program has allowances for retiring state employees to continue their medical coverage, all other city, county, fire district employees. We have a group plan form. And I think that that's another thing that this program offers to, that a lot of states do not offer
it's
to their
people. It's just deducted out of their monthly
Yes, it's benefit. Deducted out of their monthly benefit. But they have the right to immediately go in and get a group program where in many places, once they're dropped, they're left at the mercy of whatever they can find. I'll try and answer any other questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Those group rates are normally about half of what it would cost them to go out on the private market and buy single health insurance.
Representative Bauman, Senator Monroe. Maybe not quite half, but the important thing is that they can get it. In many other cases where they even, regardless of what they would want to pay, the insurance company would say you've got to take a physical examination and they could not pass the physical or something like that. But yes, it would probably be 40 to 50% lower also. I think both factors are meaningful.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, there is actually carried right on from the day they retire. They have that option to go right on into and stay right in the group that they're in, right? Is that what you said?
Representative Bauman, yes. Representative Simpson, for instance, when you retire, you the Blue Cross coverage I presume you have now, you would just continue it right on. It would be the exact same coverage that you have, and we would just take the premium out of your check for you and your...
But the premium that we're paying on the day before your retirement, does that change
2%,
on the day you...
There's a 2% handling charge.
Mr. Chairman, for state employees, there are two options. One is to consider to continue in the group that you are in as an employee. You get the benefit of being in the group with the active employees, and the PERS will deduct the payments. The other option that is used by employees who, for one reason or another, perhaps aren't with the state, can't continue is that they have their own negotiated group insurance for those employees. So for state employees, there are two options, and I can't speak for local government.
And another question.
Yes, right.
How long has it been since a witness left New York?
Representative Bauman, I waited for my payment for being in World War II, and then I got out of there in 1948.
Well, you've held your accent beautifully.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry we're late. We had another committee meeting. Was there any comments made during the period of time before we came that indicated the status of our fund as far as being funded, what percentage funded it was, or did that subject come up?
Yes, Ken went into that, and I don't know if Mark's going to come back to that.
We are right at the point on the agenda where the actuary is going to deal with the funding issue and how we are funded. So why don't we just turn to that piece?
Thank you. I must start out by saying I'm not a member of PERS, not a state employee. I'm a member of a national firm with offices in Portland and 16 other cities across the country, and we have been retained by PERS, served at the pleasure of the board through contract, and have been since 1975.
Mark, what does FSA mean?
FSA means I'm a fellow in the Society of Actuaries.
And what if you're
I
FCA
sweat blood for 9.5 years to get those three initials after my name.
And what do you do to get the C, the FCAS?
FCAS is a fellow in the Casualty Actuarial Society. Those folks deal with things like homeowner rates, automobile rates, and so forth, where I deal with pensions.
Gotcha. Okay.
I like to narrow down all pension funding into one simple formula. And if it passed, my 8-year-old daughter, I think, could understand this formula. But really, the cost of any pension system is determined by the benefits you pay out. It's also determined by the expenses that you incur to run the system. So those two things add up, and you subtract from that the investment earnings that you make on any funds that are sitting idle, not being used to pay benefits. And that determines the cost. The unfortunate problem is you can't determine that cost until every employee has retired and every retiree has died. It is our job to allocate that cost in a more orderly fashion. In order to do that, we We like to think we get very scientific, and we do. In cases this large, we can do some very sophisticated things that we wouldn't ordinarily do, for example, a pension plan covering 100 people or 20 people or one person. But really, the purpose of what we're doing in our valuations is to allocate the costs in an orderly fashion so that one generation of taxpayers isn't putting in more than the next generation for service of employees in the system over the same period of time. There are three times when we do valuations. There are three different types. One is a periodic valuation of the entire system. We're in the process right now of evaluating the system as of December 31st, 1982. The last time we undertook this major valuation was December 31st, 1979, so it has been 3 years. Generally, we've been waiting 2 years, but this particular time, there's a three-year period in between. The other time we perform a valuation is for a new employer who's joining the system at a point where we're not doing a valuation. For example, right now, if an employer is coming to PERS and says, I want to join on July 1, we have to establish a contribution rate for that employer. So there's a valuation done at that point. The third time is when legislation is considered. For almost every bill we have looked at, we have considered whether there is a fiscal impact involved, and in many where there has been serious consideration of the bill and where there is a major impact, we have gone to great lengths to study the impact of that bill and what the cost would possibly be. I like to look at the system as having three pots of money. One pot belongs to people who are now retired. Another pot belongs to the employees. It's their money that they put in. And the third pot belongs to all the employers. It's the money that they've put in. The money that's sitting out there for retirees loses ground every month. I think Jerry mentioned that $12 million a month is going out for this system to pay retiree benefits.
And about how much is coming in?
I suspect it's growing, so it's probably more than $12 million.
About $33 million a month is already.
$33 million is coming into the system from employers, but every month when somebody retires, money is transferred from their own employee account and from the employer account into that pot of money for retirees.
Oh, I see.
Enough that we estimate to pay for that entire benefit.
Yeah. Okay.
So that pot of money for the retirees, at least every time we do evaluation, is what I would consider fully funded. There's enough money for retirees to pay them no matter what, as long as they live, based upon our assumptions as to how long they live and so forth. The pot of money for the employees is determined by how much money is put in there and the interest it earns. Employees are generally putting in 6% of their payroll right now. And it increases when they retire. Their pot is either paid back to them. If they quit, it's paid to them. If they retire and choose not to take their own money out in a lump sum, that money is transferred to the retired life pot. Okay. And the third pot is the employer part. Again, money goes out of there only when somebody draws a retirement or a disability benefit or a death benefit. The problem that we face is, how does money get in there? It comes in there from the employer contributions. The big question is, how much should go in? Money is determined going into the retired life reserve. We have a good feel on how much should be in there based upon that particular individual. He's 65 years old. We figure he's going to live 19 more years. Let's put X amount of dollars in there. The employee money is determined by statute, 6%. We know how much has to go in there. We don't know how much has to go in the employer reserve. That's our job to estimate that. So really what we're talking about are estimates over a long period of time, so that after every employee is retired and every retiree and beneficiary has died, there'll be enough money. If we've done our job well at that point in time, that last dollar will be paid out as that last person dies. In order to do this, we make projections as to what benefits will be paid in the future. And obviously we do this by computer for 150,000 people, but essentially what we're doing is we're predicting what benefits will be paid, how large they'll be, and how long they will continue. We base this on certain assumptions, since we can tell what happened in the past, and we use that to guess, if you will, what will happen in the future. For example, Jerry mentioned four things can happen. Somebody can quit, they can be disabled. Actually, they can be disabled two different ways, on the job or off the job. They can die, or they can retire. For example, if somebody quits, there's again two things that can happen. They can take their money out, forfeit the employer part, or they can leave their money in and become an inactive participant. Then two things can happen. They can die in the interim, or they can live to retire and eventually receive a benefit. Once they retire, they can do several things. They can take a lump sum benefit of their own money and a monthly payment of the employer amount. They can take a monthly payment of the whole amount. And then you have to figure out, how long are they going to live? What's the consumer price index going to be? Is that 2% cost of living going to happen every year? Okay, so that's just what happens when people quit. You do the same type of thing for everything. So you can see it gets fairly complicated, and it takes quite a while to do. We're now toward the end of June, getting the numbers together for what happened at the end of December. We received the data in March, and it's taken us 2 or 3 months now to get the results, and the results will be presented, at least for the state and the schools, on June 24th. Okay, so now we've got a projection of all the benefits that are going to be paid in the future. What we do is we discount them back to the valuation date using an interest rate. We happen to use right now 7.5%. We feel that 7.5% is a reasonable rate of return to use, not for what I could earn this month or last month, but what could be earned over a long period of time. The time frame we're dealing with, for example, for an employee age 30 might not retire to 60. There's 30 years. They might live another 20, so we're talking about periods of 40, 50, 60 years or more, not just what I can go down and get a 90-day note for. So we don't really need to have the dollars that we project will eventually be paid. We don't need to have that in our pot right now. We need something in our pot now which will grow with interest to be able to pay those off. So now we've got a value today of all the benefits that will be paid in the future. Well, we can subtract what we've got already. We've got assets, almost $3 billion, over $3 billion in assets. We can subtract that. We don't need to look for that in the future. We've got that there. We assume it's going to grow at 7.5%, for example. We also know employees are going to be contributing in the future, according to the statute, the way it's written now. So we can predict how much money will be put in the future from the out of the employee's paycheck. So we can subtract that. What's left is what the employer needs to put in. Okay, so you got a projection of all the benefits. You can subtract what you've got now. You can subtract what the employees are going to put in, and that's what the employer must put in. We go through this process for the state combined, for all the school districts combined, and for each of the individual political subdivisions. In other words, we do this some 300 or 400 odd times and determine how much money each of those employers should put in. There's two ways that we calculate that money should be put in from an employer. One is we'll call a normal cost. A normal cost is a percentage of payroll that would be assumed to be paid from the time somebody is hired until they retire. So that would be a rate that you would consider sufficient for somebody who you're just going to hire, if that's a typical person. That percent of payroll from the time that guy's hired till the time he retires will be sufficient to pay for all of his various benefits. Unfortunately, that's not going to be enough. And the reason that's not going to be enough is that at any point in time, you may not have put that much in for that individual in the past. Reasons for that may be that you increased benefits retroactively. So now you discover that, well, for the past 10 years, we've been putting in 8% of payroll for Joe. You told us that was enough. Well, now you changed the ballgame on me. You should have been putting in 9%. You were a percent short for the last 8 years. You got to put that up. Okay, well, we're saying you don't have to put it up right now. We'll treat it something like a mortgage. You can pay it off over 30 years. And as Ken mentioned, that's one of the goals and objectives of the board. You've got to pay off that mortgage, if you will, in 30 years. Some systems say you don't have to pay it off. We'll just let it ride. Some systems say you only have to pay interest on it, which is much more popular. But by far, the soundest way to do it is to establish a criteria for paying that off for a given number of years. PRS has done that. There are other ways which create the so-called unfunded liability. The unfunded liability is the difference in that normal cost versus what it should have been versus what you paid. That unfunded liability is also created by, for example, salaries being higher than we expected. One of the many assumptions we make is how salaries are going to increase. If salaries have increased faster than we anticipated, you didn't put enough money. If fewer people quit than we expect, you didn't put enough money in, because we expected when those people quit, some of them would leave, take their money, and there'd be this this advantage to the employers that we would spread out. If fewer people quit than we expected, that forfeiture is not going to be there, and you're going to have to put in more money from your employer contribution rate. If the assets don't grow as fast as we expect, if they have poor investment year after poor investment year, the assets aren't there that we expected to be there, so the employer is going to have to put more money in. Okay. So these two different types of rates, the normal cost payment for a typical employee and paying off this unfunded liability, which is like a mortgage, are both done as a level percentage of payroll, which means that as long as three things happen, that percentage should stay the same. Number one, if the experience of the members of the system is what we expect, if our assumptions are realized, that's one criteria. That needs to happen for that rate to stay the same. That's our responsibility. We study that, we look at that. If we blow that, that's our fault. Number two, the contributions that we recommend that are necessary have to be made. If we say the state needs to put in 10%, then by golly, the state says, no, we can't afford it. We're only going to put in 4%. It's a perfect example of pay me now or pay me later. If our assumptions are realized, you're going to be short. Next time we do evaluation, we won't come back and say 10. It'll be 10.5 or 11 or something else. Okay, so the contributions that we recommend have to be made. That, in the past, has been the board's responsibility, and the board, the PRS board, has been very good about adopting the rates that we recommend. In fact, I don't think, at least since 75, there's been no exception. If we've said there has to be a rate increase, sometimes it's been deferred, but it's been deferred in a mathematically proper way, such that pay me now or pay me later. In other words, if they don't pay, we say 1% now, and they say, well, we can't pay now, but we'll start paying in January of 84, it's a little bit more than 1% when they start to make up the difference.
Mark, if I might interrupt, I would emphasize what you just said. That's one of the if Oregon gets a gold star, it's for that point that you have never adopted a benefit that you haven't immediately started to fund. And that's why we're in the sound financial condition that we are today. And certainly the hope of the board that we would never deviate from that standard, because we'll keep ourselves out of trouble by continuing to do this.
Okay, so if the experience is what we assume, if the contributions that we recommend are made, and one other thing, if there are no benefit changes, if you change the benefits on us, that means all our projections are wrong. If you increase benefits, that means that we told you to put in 9%, it's not 9% anymore, and that's your responsibility. If you increase a benefit, I think it's your responsibility to know what the additional cost is going to be. And the PRS board, as Ken said, has always increased employer rates as we recommend, to pay for additional benefits. When a bill comes to us, we look at several different things to try and predict what the extra cost should be. We're projecting an increase in the normal cost rate if it affects new people coming in. If it's a benefit that only affects people who are there now, then there won't be an increase in the normal cost, because there wouldn't be an increased benefit for a typical new entrant coming in. Okay. There's also an increase in an unfunded liability for almost every benefit change, unless that benefit only affects new people coming in the future. If that benefit change affects anybody who's now in the system, there is theoretically going to be an increase in the unfunded liability for which your mortgage payment will have to go up, so to speak. In the past, we have always determined a cost for each bill separately. This has usually not posed a significant problem. In 1981, however, when there were several bills passed, there was interplay between them that caused the total cost to be greater than the sum of the cost for each of the different bills. The prime example is early retirement on the full formula. You got a bigger benefit quicker coming from two different directions, and it compounded itself. So we have to be careful about that. But still, it's not really efficient for us to cost the impact of every combination of bills before they pass. It's just not possible to do that.
Are those is that analysis done blind to the board's position?
Yes, absolutely. I guess, you know, that if there are no further questions, that concludes my discussion on funding. Just to summarize, the system takes pains to be well-funded. The board reacts very favorably to the recommendations. As a state system, it's very well-funded. Because of the fact that they've always, so to speak, picked up that mortgage payment.
Will the three of you be back as we go through these bills, or just two? Mark, do you?
I came in on a request.
You came in on a request, okay. Yes, Mike.
I appreciate the detailed explanation. I was hoping at some point to have someone say that we were 90% funded or 100% funded or what. Can you tell me in your best judgment?
Well, I can tell you as of 3 years ago,
excuse me, Mike, one thing that went on earlier is they're just finishing this three-year analysis. In 10 more days, we'll have the most recent stuff, but until then, I mean, for now, we got to go with the 79 numbers.
We're going to have that shortly, is that what you're saying? Where were we 3 years
ago? 3 years ago, there were, after fully funding all the retiree pot, if you will, the employers had funded approximately 90% of the benefits that had been earned up to the date of the valuation. In other words, you wouldn't expect them to pay in advance for all the benefits that will be earned in the future. We are anticipating salary increases, so in a sense we are trying to pay up in advance for certain increases. But just a one-shot look as of December 31st, 79, approximately 90% of the benefits that had been earned as of that date were funded, which is excellent.
Certainly you must have some judgment on where we are now.
We really don't. I would suspect we would be better than that. I'd prefer to leave it at that and talk to you in a few weeks.
Hopefully we won't be here in a few weeks.
Max, Jake and Vance.
The unfunded liability. On this front of this page here, on the pie, that isn't listed. That's totally separate, and you didn't give us a figure on that.
Well, I can give you a figure as of 3 years ago.
Yeah.
an unfunded liability of approximately $880 million. But again, don't let that scare you.
No.
Because it's not a liability in the sense of... It's not a liability in the sense of something that is accrued and is now due. You don't owe that right now any more than you would owe the liability for future salaries, for example.
For example, on the mortgage of my house, I have a $20,000 loan. I have an unfunded liability.
And as long as you're making your monthly payments, we'll say your house is pretty well funded. You're not just paying the interest. You're not ignoring it. You're paying principal and interest over a set period of time. You expect to pay it off at a certain point in time. We'd say you're well funded.
What do you use that figure for then?
We use that figure to allocate the cost between what a typical employee would pay, and then what's ever left is this unfunded liability, which is a mortgage payment. If I'm using that term loosely, but that is essentially the mechanism that's going on. It's a way to keep the contributions a level percentage of payroll. If we didn't do it that way, if we, in other words, said, you have got to pay for all the benefits by the time everybody retires, not 30 years. In other words, the average future lifetime may be 16 years or 20 years or something. If we say you have to pay for that by the time they retire, what will happen is your cost right now will be much higher. And as people retire, it may come down or it may go up at different points in time. This method, there are many different ways to fund a retirement system. The method we have chosen is one which has the highest probability of producing a level percentage of payroll, which makes it a good budgeting tool. So, in a sense, it's a technical way to try and keep the percentage of as a level percentage of payroll.
Mr. Chairman, are all actuaries callous about debt?
Last month, the chairman of the board, Judge Langtry, asked me if I took into consideration he was going to live to be 106. I told him yes.
It's about 9:05 this day. It's much longer than it ever deserved to be already. Yesterday, I think you all received a copy of a memo. I asked the co-chairs for certain bills to be assigned to the subcommittee. That's a small subset of about 35 to 40 that could reasonably come to us. I had no real interest in any of the others. If you want to see that entire list that's in here, well, it's certainly, this is a bigger list than we